Actually, Lewis, I was hoping you were going to offer me the mandate of leading the group in prayer. But if it's secularism you want, as you notice, David shrewdly, one might even say guilefully, built upon a Madison quote, which was first found elsewhere. And my tasks were various. I could either devise something to say or borrow shrewdly. And I actually asked Gore Vidal whether he would share with me some of those pages that he didn't use. And the issue now is whether what you hear is pages he loaned me, or whether I have to do it myself. You'll find the cadence varies, the humor is not as good, the pungency is lacking, and thus, unfortunately, this is autonomous and less derivative than I would prefer. I wanted to talk about two themes that are central to much of what has brought us together, that is terrorism and intervention. As humans, whether American or not, we certainly do and properly should deplore the killing of non-combatants who by definition are or virtually are innocent. But not only has President Bush, I guess we now refer to him as George II or Bush the Younger, or the cheerleader who's president, I'm not quite sure of what the designation should be, but I guess we know whom I'm speaking about. He's told us that what happened on 9/11 was unique. It was the incarnation of an extreme evil virtually unmatched in human history and certainly in the 20th century, that these things should not happen to America. And yet, let's just scan briefly a little bit of history. If one of the defining criteria of terrorism is action against non-combatants, and I think we should properly revile the killing of about 3,000 mostly Americans on 9/11, let's think of not the towers in New York City, but let's try some other nouns that may resonate interestingly in history. Let me try, not at random, Dresden, Hamburg, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Tokyo. I pick those five nouns of cities because in each of them, at least 35,000 people were killed. In some of them, Tokyo and Hiroshima, the numbers may come closer to 100,000. Now, it's true, they weren't Americans. And it's true it was a war. And furthermore, it's true that for the most part, those who died were non-combatants. And furthermore, it was known that non-combatants would be primarily killed. It was not accident, it was not bombing going astray. It was conception implemented with shrewdness, acuity, vengeance, and lethality. So what is so markedly distinctive about 9/11? Well, one, it happened to us, America. Secondly, it happened in New York City. Some Americans might have applauded that, but there's a kind of narrow patriotism in much of this. And furthermore, one of the distinctions often used, and I think wonderfully uncompelling, is that the terrorism recently was not state-directed, and of course the action against Dresden or Hamburg or Hiroshima, Nagasaki, or Tokyo was state-directed. And that is certainly a difference. Whether it's a compelling moral difference, I seriously doubt. But let me move to the issue of intervention. That is, speedily, George II told us that the appropriate answer was to destroy Osama bin Laden, the Al-Qaeda network, all those who harbored him, all those who supported him, and others so associated. Of course, there's been some failure. He, referring not to George II, but to Osama bin Laden, presumably continues. Parts of the Al-Qaeda network presumably do, although lower-level people have been gotten. But let me offer you a hypothetical. Let's assume for a moment that indeed the President in the United States has thus enacted a series of military actions which indeed had gotten bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network, nobody else, killed no non-combatants, had not torn up Afghanistan, had not destroyed other people. How many of us would think that this was a proper response? My suspicion is, and I myself am a bit ambivalent about this, that most of us would have a visceral reaction that a parsimonious, focused military act getting the malefactors and not others is a warranted and not an unwarranted act. Some of us would be troubled by the notion of an eye for an eye, kind of modern-day American Hammurabi code. Some of us might well be troubled by the fact that this seems to depart from notions of procedure and law, that there's something unsystematic and wanton and indeed arrogant about it. It is, but why primarily should so many of us be concerned about the acts the American government took? Well, first of all, of course, they were arrogant. Secondly, the contention was that 9/11 was unique, not simply in details on that day in New York City, et cetera, but really in substance, that things like this had not happened in history to anyone before. But furthermore, we know, of course, that much of the killing conducted by the American state in Afghanistan has been against non-combatants, not against combatants. Bombing is remarkably inefficient. It hits some people near where we aim if the intelligence is not unduly defective and may even get some of the right people as well. It tears apart a nation, and now a president who said he would never go into the nation-building business has announced he's going into the nation-building business. We'll do it in some fashion for some time in ways ill-defined, at costs not specified, to produce results unclear. But what this leads one to, if I may come back to the original theme with which I began and moved in rather desultory and spastic fashion, that indeed the United States is a terrorist state. It's not unique, but it is a terrorist state.
Robert Hill.
For most of us, national security policies and practices are remote from our immediate experience. What we know about them is what we see on television, what we read in the newspapers. As a result, I think we are apt to become the victims of illusions. And in the short while allotted to me, I would like to speak of three particular ways in which I think many of us are subject to illusions, and to contrast those illusions with what I take to be reality. Illusion number one: the U.S. Defense Department protects the American people in America. Reality number one: the Defense Department occupies itself overwhelmingly in preparing for or engaging in foreign wars against persons who do not, in fact, pose serious threats to the American people in America. During the Cold War, the Defense Department prepared for wars in Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and elsewhere against the Soviet Union and its surrogates. In so doing, the U.S. military establishment routinely protected regimes that at least pretended to oppose communism, no matter how tyrannical or murderous those regimes were. Since the end of the Cold War, the Defense Department has undertaken to defend certain persons, many of them none too savory, in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Kurdistan, and southern Iraq, in Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, and Kosovo, as well as the usual suspects, Western Europe, Japan, and South Korea.
Very little of this activity has had a direct connection with actually protecting the American people in America, and much of it has had no genuine connection whatsoever. Illusion number two. The Defense Department has the motivation and the capacity to effectively manage the vast resources placed at its disposal in a way that enhances the security of the American people in America. Reality number two. The Defense Department is either unable or unwilling to deal seriously with its decades-long engagement in massive waste, fraud, and mismanagement, especially, but not exclusively, in its relations with the big defense contracting companies. The Defense Department will not even obey the laws with regard to its own accounting practices. According to a report by the department's own inspector general, dated February 15 last year, quote, "We identified $1.1 trillion in department-level accounting entries to financial data used to prepare DOD component financial statements that were not supported by adequate audit trails or by sufficient evidence to determine their validity." That was $1.1 trillion that could not be validated. Continuing to quote, "In addition, we also identified $107 billion in department-level accounting entries to financial data used to prepare DOD component financial statements that were improper because the entries were illogical or did not follow accounting principles. Further, DOD did not fully comply with the laws and regulations that had a direct and material effect on its ability to determine financial statement amounts." And to think, Congress is wasting time holding hearings on the shortcomings of Arthur Andersen and Enron, which are veritable paragons of accounting probity by comparison with the Pentagon. Now, obviously, various parties benefit from this blatant lawlessness and public irresponsibility, but my time does not permit me to take up the question, cui bono. Illusion number three. Since September 11, everything is different. Reality number three. Very little of any significance has changed in the allocation of funds and the material conduct of the U.S. military and intelligence apparatus since September 11. The most notable change is that the Bush administration and Congress have seen fit to give vast additional amounts of taxpayer money, amounts projected to increase annual defense spending by some $120 billion in the next 5 years. Amounts that in large part are certain to be wasted in the usual fashion. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld himself said in testimony last year before Congress, and I quote, "We have an obligation to taxpayers to spend their money wisely. Today, we are not doing that," end quote. The destruction of the World Trade Center, not to speak of the damage to the Pentagon itself, will remain forever an indictment of the failure of U.S. defense and intelligence policy. The most curious upshot of this terrible failure is that the President and Congress have not seen fit to punish those responsible for the failure. No heads have rolled. Hell, nobody's even had his wrist slapped. Instead, the failed defense and intelligence establishment is now being rewarded with the greatest infusion of new taxpayer money it has seen in a generation.
address what should be done, part of the title of this forum. Let me go back to last September when President George Bush declared, our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. As David pointed out in his introductory remarks, like the war on illegal drugs, the war on terrorism cannot be won. We will always have homegrown terrorists such as Timothy McVeigh or the Unabomber. There will always be a few people and a few people in the world who hate us. So we have to face that fact. We cannot win that war. Now, Bush has called for a new Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. He did this earlier this week, inserted, quote, we will stay until the mission is done. What is the mission? How will we know when it's done? Will it be when we get bin Laden, dead or alive? We may never find his body. So the war, Bush's pronouncement is a recipe for staying indefinitely in Afghanistan. Now, our desire for revenge after 9/11 is natural. We are the strongest power in the world has ever seen, not only in absolute terms, but relative to the rest of the world. Our overwhelming success in the Gulf War, with only 148 U.S. deaths, our victory in Kosovo without any fatalities, our conquering of Afghanistan with only a handful of casualties, has given the impression that our military is invincible. Nevertheless, we should be careful and think carefully about where we are. To quote Lord Acton, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we're getting corrupted absolutely. Our military, no matter how invincible, cannot eliminate the suicide bomber, the terrorist who will die for his cause. As long as people hate us, we will be vulnerable. The Israelis have been trying in vain to stamp out the Palestinian terrorist attacks. Ariel Sharon, who came to power promising security through stronger action, has seen a rise in violence since he took office and an increase in Jewish deaths. His military efforts have just produced more violence. And we in Afghanistan have killed 3,000 to 3,400 Afghan civilians, about as many as died in 9/11. Secretary Powell last week made the same point about Israel. He said to the Israelis, no matter how effective the Israeli defenses will be, there will still be people who will resort to violence and terror. The anger and the frustration will still be there. Now, why can't the administration understand that terrorism against the United States, like that against Israel, cannot be eliminated by military might? Well, we cannot eliminate... While we cannot eliminate terrorism, we can reduce its frequency and violence. We should consider its roots. This does not mean that we are justifying the attacks on our people and our land, but that we recognize that terrorists have objectives. Osama bin Laden has told us why he's attacking us. It is because we have troops in the holy territory of Saudi Arabia. In fact, he was not notably against the United States prior to the Gulf War, and it was when we stationed troops in Saudi Arabia that he turned his hatred to us. And in his first tape after 9/11, he promised, quote, I swear to God that America will not live in peace before all the army of infidels depart the land of the Prophet Muhammad. Not only does he feel this way, but so do many millions in the Islamic world. Since 9/11, we have deployed troops in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Georgia, also in the Philippines and Colombia. We are talking about stationing our troops in the Sudan and Yemen. In fact, we are pressuring the Yemenis to take our troops. In each of these countries, the local populace resent our presence. In Muslim countries, the opposition is particularly hostile since they see Christianity on another crusade to invade Islam. Wherever we have bases, the local population resents those troops. In Okinawa, the natives strongly oppose the U.S. soldiers stationed on their island. Many of the South Korean population hate the American military in their midst. American troops abroad furnish both a motivation for terrorism and a target. If we brought our men and women home, would we be safer or less safe? I think the answer is clear. We would reduce the motivation to attack us. Americans would be seen more as we think we are, peaceful people who wish good things for the world. I realize this goes against the grain. It would seem as given in to Osama bin Laden. But if our objective is to reduce terrorism, it's the most practical and probably the only way to do it. Let us not let a misguided machismo stand in the way of protecting our people and reducing violence in the world. Bringing our troops home. By the way, why do we have soldiers in Germany and Okinawa? I thought the Cold War was over. Bringing our troops home would increase our security, not decrease it. Even before September 11th, more than 60,000 U.S. military were operating in over 100 countries around the world. No wonder people consider America an imperial power. If we also reduced our unseemly favoritism for Israel by taking a more neutral stance, our credibility in the world... Our credibility in the world, and especially in the Arab countries, would increase immensely. This, too, would help reduce the hatred that many feel towards the U.S. George W. Bush explained to Congress why the terrorists hate America. He said, "They hate what we see right here in this chamber, a democratically elected government. They hate our freedoms, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other." The president is wrong. According to a Zogby International poll released last week, a majority of people in 5 Arab countries and 3 non-Arab Muslim states view our freedom and our democracy with favor, but overwhelmingly they disapprove of our policies towards the Arab nations and the Palestinians. Kuwait, for example, who remember we rescued from Iraq, liked our freedom and democracy by 58% to 39%, but only 6% viewed our policies favorably, and a huge 88% disapproved of our policy in the Middle East. Other Muslim countries had almost identical views, and this poll was taken before Israel sent its military into the West Bank. Finally, attacking West Iraq or any other Middle Eastern country will only increase the number of terrorists that will seek to get revenge. Let us reduce terrorism, not increase it. The policies currently being followed and those being talked about will only produce more 9/11s. Security cannot come from violence. We should follow Thomas Jefferson's advice from his first inaugural: peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. Thank you.
I'm taken by the three statements. Didn't you think that was good news?
Wonderful news. Keep spreading the good news.
Yeah. We have some questions on the card, Gore, and one is, what is the difference between the United States war on terrorism and Israel's war on terrorism?
Well,
did you just answer that question?
But I think it was well laid out, yes.
Yes. Okay.
To be a little more even-handed in our dealings with the Muslim world. Terrorism is terrorism in any case. We should have turned over the whole thing when we were attacked, if it was indeed Osama who did it. The whole thing, this is perfect for the UN. Kofi Annan is well trusted. And this is for CIA, FBI, this is for police work, not military work. And it's, again, that mixing up of the military with the other. You know, a few years ago in Italy, the mafia in Palermo blew up the chief of police and his wife in a car as they're driving in great state through Palermo. Had it happened in Dallas, the United States would have bombed Dallas. The Italians did not bomb Palermo, even though all the mafia does its shopping there, and you know, you're bound to hit some of the family. Instead, they sent the police after them, and they got about half of the leadership of the mafia. And that's Italy, which is not known for being terribly attentive.
I have a question for Bob Higgs. Peace and free trade go hand in hand, but the special interests are our special interests. We can't even lower tariffs on textile imports from our poor new ally Pakistan. In other words, is there a way of reconciling our economic interests with our declared faith in liberty and what Tom was trying to say, an even-handed policy?
Well, indeed, I think the two interests go hand in hand. It's been observed by wiser men than I that when goods cannot freely cross borders, soldiers will. In the middle of the 19th century, it was well understood that free trade was one of the most effective policies to promote peace. And although it's certainly not the only policy that would tend to promote peace, it certainly would work in that direction.
Even though we have all the deck loaded in our favor. In other words, there are something like, I think, 36 or 37 wars going on in the world today, and most of them about the control of a single commodity. Mm-hmm. So that you know more about this than I do.
Well, the objective of free trade is simply to withdraw government discretion from telling people with whom they may make exchanges. And there's nothing in that withdrawal that promotes war whatsoever. Wars are the work of governments. And the government policy of free trade is simply a policy of hands-off, of saying to people, if you wish to buy and sell with people from Pakistan, go to it. If you wish to deal with the people of North Korea, go to it. And of course, nothing in that sort of commerce would bring about violence. Free trade is the kind of exchange from which everyone benefits. That's why they enter into it.
Gore, do you think we have another question is to you? Does the word liberal mean anything anymore?
Last time I looked, it didn't. However, this is the great triumphs of our civilization, and we have had a few. We're all liberal measures. I remember the first debate I remember in Congress was 1935, and Roosevelt had introduced Social Security. And I fear my conservative grandfather was against it, but it finally passed. But the right wing said, if this passes, you will cease to have a name and only a number. You are going to lose your name if Social Security went through. Well, it went through. I have now lived long enough to see the conservatives were right. The Social Security number is now our tag, our prisoner's tag. It's used for taxes, it's used for plastic cards, it's used for everything to keep control over us. Little knowing that back then those fools were right, the honking geese. Not that I'm for revoking it.
Another question to you is, would things have been any different had your cousin, Al Gore, been elected president of the United States?
Consanguinity forbids my candor.
Yeah, all right, sure. One issue which has not been an issue since the new war on terrorism is the issue of gays in the military. Might there be a plan to develop a queers brigade, is that right?
Queens Brigade.
Queens Brigade, to be used as fodder either in front of or in back of the black troops. Well, this is a very ambitious program. Have you tried the ministry? There's also a question that touches on Bob Higgs about the illusions of the Defense Department. Are there any way of revealing those illusions? I mean, can those be made clearer? I mean, have those illusions been in effect for how long? And how long are they likely to stay in effect?
They are illusions of very long standing, but they need not remain forever. And a number of people have made it their business to try to reveal the reality. One source you will find on the web at independent.org. Look under Defense and Foreign Policy on our website, and I believe you'll find many illusions shattered there.
Do any of you think that we have plans to the United States would to proceed with a war against Iran, a war in Central Asia, an even more active, aggressive, imperial foreign policy?
Yes.
Do you think that's possible?
Of course.
You don't build up
a great army unless you intend to use it. This is poor Jefferson figured that out at the very beginning, as did Madison in the Federalist Papers, that you don't have a standing army because you'll use it and it'll be very expensive. And what happens? And then poor Jefferson ends up inventing the Navy because we were busy fighting the Barbary pirates. So he gives us a Navy which he didn't really think we ought to have, but we fell into that one. We fall into a lot of things. But
would there be any sense or means or way of our shrinking our military presence?
Well, I think we're going to run out of money. It seems to me pretty clear the rich no longer pay anything. Junior saw to that. So they've been exempted from taxes. Corporate America used to tax on corporate profits, provided the revenues of the government is something like 45% of the total. We, the people, pay up another 45%, 46% in income tax. We're still paying 45 or 6%, and corporate America on its profits now provides us with 10% of the revenues of the state. Well, when you have a country so deeply crooked, how do you straighten it out? I don't know. But I think we will run out of money. I mean, there are plus signs. And finally, I think the world shows a certain fatigue with us, which I think is going to get worse.
This question is grassroots activism relevant?
Oh, yes, I think it's probably the only thing that might be useful at any given moment. We watched the far right take over school boards, and everybody laughed. You know, everybody's so busy creating presidents. But Mr. Vigory and those money raisers down in Virginia, they just said, we're tired of losing, and we're going to go after the school boards. Nobody cares about those elections, and we'll grab them. So then they go to the county level, and they go to the state level. They've been very successful. And it also helps that religion is tax exempt, something that the First Amendment did not mean. If I were in charge of things, I would tax every religion.
I want to ask the panel if they think grassroots activism is relevant. Or, I mean, Tom Moore began to talk about the kind of idealism that we ought to put into action, but I mean, what is to be done?
You're asking me?
I'm asking all four of you. I mean,
Well, as I said, I think what we first should do is pull our troops out of the rest of the world and go back to let the Defense Department be a Defense Department defending us from this, our soil here, not from the rest of the world. And then, as Thomas Jefferson said, we should trade with the rest of the world. I would agree with Bob that the best thing we can do for the rest of the world is trade with them. I think it's obscene that we have barriers to buying textiles from poor state countries in Africa. That's the one thing they have to sell us that could make them some money and get them out of poverty. And I think it's obscene that we have these restrictions on purchases from poor countries. We ought to be allowing these imports would help the rest of the world get out of their abject conditions. That's what we should be doing.
And what about at home? What about domestically? The government's still setting the, you know, going
well,
back
we,
to...
Well, I must say, Gore made a reference to the Roman Empire, and it occurred to me the other day that... Attorney General Ashcroft was probably the worst appointment since Caligula appointed his horse to the Senate, and so we are losing our freedoms right and left. I could go down chapter and verse and the Patriot Act that we. Eroded a lot of our freedoms, and even when the courts tried to intervene, the Justice Department under Ashcroft won't stop. We've incarcerated, well, the State Department last month listed a number of countries on their, they have a human rights violations, and a number of countries like China and North Korea. And they condemned them for having thrown people in jail for long periods of time without charging them and had secret trials. Why didn't they list the United States in that list, too? I mean, what we're doing here to our freedoms, I think, is just terrible.
Anyway, we are as one.
Yeah. there are a lot of questions that have come in about wanting further remarks from all of you on the situation in Israel, to comment on your attitudes toward the Israeli occupation. What do you think about that? I mean, there have been many people that would like some. Go ahead.
Well, Sharon in Lebanon gave us a foretaste of what his administration would be like, and it has proven to be. He seems to be out of control, and whatever comes out of this, he has no exit in mind other than Armageddon. And that's serious. And at this point, if we had a government in the United States, we might do something quite active. Just draw a line in the sand, if nothing more, saying, oh, look, we've given you a lot of aid over the years, and we would like a little something back, like peace.
Tom?
Well, Ariel Sharon, when he ran for office, promised two things. One was to torpedo the Oslo procedures, and the other was to bring security to Israel. Well, he's battling 500%, which in baseball is pretty good. He got rid of the Oslo Peace Accord. And he is a disaster. What I think the sorties proposed is the only sensible thing to do. You go back to the 1967 line with some adjustments, but what was supposedly a generous proposal at the Camp David was not very generous. It would have divided 85% of the settlers would have stayed on the West Bank, and they would have been divided into the effect would have been divided the West Bank into four separate cantons, not contiguous. And the Israelis were going to control the borders, the skies, and the water supply. It's a little hard to call that an independent state they were talking about.
Gore, this is from a person that's read your book who says, what are some of the other ways of getting back at a tyrannical government that that are not as extreme as McVeigh? What other means, without blowing up a building in Oklahoma City?
An unpleasant letter to Janet Reno.
if we give her thought. But if we have nobody in the Congress making the argument.
Well, we don't, because we don't have representative government. We gave that up some time ago. They represent, yes, but only corporate America. They don't represent the citizens. So in the absence of corporate government, you're going to have a lot of independent contractors like Timothy McVeigh, which is indeed the chaos and anarchy that Judge Brandeis was warning against when government, which is the great teacher itself, runs berserk and becomes criminal in its actions against the people. It is a criminal government, and its main target for its crimes are the people of the United States, who are well and truly ripped off in the interest of the Russians are coming, we've got to stop them. We've got to stop all drugs, all terrorism everywhere on earth. I mean, the dumbness, these dumb statements that come out. Are we going to also alleviate all pain? Why not? It's a great goal. I'd go along with that. Except in the case of certain people, but we all have our lists of exemptions.
Do any of our historians have a notion of how to get back at a tyrannical government without blowing up a building?
I think many people have already discovered how to act individually to withdraw their assistance from a government they regard as fundamentally illegitimate. And they do that simply by taking every opportunity they find and looking for new ones to withdraw their support, to not obey the laws they regard as unjust, and little by little, those individual acts of disallegiance add up. David Hume observed way back in the early 18th century that every government rests on public opinion. And so long as public opinion supports the legitimacy of a government, even when it acts tyrannically, that government will persist. But when people finally take it upon themselves to act, at least individually, by doing what they can to withdraw every ounce of help from an illegitimate government, then that government will eventually fall.
We're coming to the end of our allotted time, Gore. Would you like to sum up the evening, or the book, or our present condition?
I don't like that phrase, allotted time.
All right.
Old age is not for beginners.
No. David, do you have other questions? This question is addressed to me. It's about the imperial presidency, who do you see in Congress safeguarding the republic? I don't see very many people in Congress. I happen to like Fritz Holland, and Kucinich is in the House.
I like Lee.
Bonnier, I'm not a Washington person. I mean, there are some. Even Byrd has been one of the few senators who's spoken about the absence of debate and the lack of dissent. But I don't see myself a powerful figure in Congress the way they may have been 20 or 30 years ago.
It shifted over to the executive.
Yeah.
And wars have done that.
I don't see a figure of the stature of, say, somebody like Sam Rubin.
Or even Lyndon Johnson before he was emperor.
Yeah, or Johnson. But I don't think that's a function of my age. I think that's partly a function of television in a funny way. I think Clinton is a character made by and for television. I think that if Reagan was an actor playing a politician, Clinton was a politician playing an actor. And the...
Well, he was also the greatest waste that I've ever seen in the presidency. Clinton had everything. But he understood the economy. He could explain it.
Yeah.
And it was all there, and then under it there was this grubby boy who was deranging him.
But I remember the front page of the New York Times to give you a sense of where I think we're at, which on the day that the impeachment trial of Clinton began in the Senate, I was in the Senate gallery, and that story appeared on page one of the Times below the fold, and above the fold, there was a large photograph of Michael Jordan, who was retiring that day from the Chicago Bulls, and there were 200 reporters in the Senate gallery, and there were 6,000 reporters in the United Center in Chicago. And that kind of told me where our politics were at. Impeachment of the President of the United States is not as big a story as the retirement of Michael Jordan.
So Caligula was right. In his appointments, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I guess you get to go sign books, I think, unless there's a last question. We've got probably two more minutes. One more. Bart, I mean, I haven't gotten more comments out of you know. This question is, you all seem to agree the United States in some way deserved attacks like 9/11. Do you think hatred from religious extremism plays a role?
Yes.
Yes.
Very simply, yes. And I regard the greatest disaster ever to befall the West was monotheism.
In show business, there's a saying that you always try to find a line to walk on. And it means to, you know, and I don't think you get a better one than that.
Particularly if there's water.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to especially thank Gore Vidal for his superb work and for taking the time to join with us. I want to thank Lewis Lapham for kindly moderating our program tonight and for our excellent panel, including Barton Bernstein, Robert Higgs, and Thomas Moore, for their comments. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for joining with us and making this evening such a successful program. As I mentioned earlier, Gore Vidal is going to be on his way shortly to the outer lobby to autograph copies of his book. And we hope that you will pick up a copy. Also, for those who have not seen a copy, we have a copy, copies of Robert Higgs' book, Crisis and Leviathan. And I'm sure that Bob would be delighted to autograph his as well. Please visit us at independent.org. And we look forward to you attending future independent events. Thank you and good night.